the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. This morning, Lynn and I talk with physicist Dr. John Matthews of the Telescope Array Project in Delta, Utah, about their cosmic ray detectors and findings. Then we share a past interview with paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson and the 50th anniversary of his discovery of the iconic fossil Lucy. Researchers once again detected another God-worthy particle, the second highest energy cosmic ray ever, and appropriately named it the Amaterasu particle after the Japanese sun goddess. Here to tell us about these particles from unknown sources and help us with our understanding of cosmic rays is Dr. John Matthews of the Telescope Array Project in Delta, Utah and the University of Utah. John, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So let's start off this conversation with a really simple, easy question. What are cosmic rays?
Cosmic rays are particles from space, from often outside the galaxy, often some from inside the galaxy, but they're coming from tremendous distances. They can be something as simple as a proton or an electron, but they can be heavier nuclei like nitrogen or iron nuclei.
Where do these particles come from? I mean, we'll get into the specifics about not knowing where the big ones came from, but in general, where did a lot of these cosmic particles originate from?
Well, at really low energies, they come from something as simple as the sun. So you get a lot of charged particles come here from the sun, from other stars, but that's at sort of the 1 billion electron volts range, which is very, very low energy for us. So low energy particles are passing through you all the time, two through your head per second, we like to say. But as you go up to higher and higher energies, then now you start to be limited by what kind of sources can generate these things. You need something more and more violent and larger scale to contain it while it gets accelerated.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with John Matthews, and we're talking about the University of Utah's Fly Eye Observatory, way out there in the West Desert near Delta. And we're talking about the Oh My God particle that was discovered a long time ago now, but there's been a recent expansion of this array. And can you talk a little bit about what it physically looks like? I think most Utahns never have been to the Dugway Proving Grounds. Talk about the atmosphere and then this array and how it has expanded.
The Fly's Eye dates back to the middle 70s. There were tests first at a place called Volcano Ranch, New Mexico, to show that you could see cosmic rays with telescopes. Then in the later 70s, the University of Utah built the original Fly's Eye out at Dugway Proving Ground. It's a military base. They do all kinds of strange and interesting tests on things you don't want to come into contact with, biological things, chemical things, not to mention conventional weapons. So originally we borrowed or leased a small hill from the Army in those days. Eventually we expanded to two hills and a small site off the side of one of the hills. So you're going in and out of a military base. Most of the time it's not a big deal. They're just checking your identification, make sure everything's okay. Occasionally they're doing a real test and then either security ramps way up or you are told to don't come on these days because we're doing something serious. In those days, mostly the Utah part has always been telescopes, fluorescence telescopes, which observe these cosmic rays as they come down through the atmosphere. The charged particle, whatever it is, collides with a nucleus high in the atmosphere, oxygen or nitrogen nucleus, blasts it apart and you get a shower of secondary particles. And so the telescopes observe that shower by the light that it generates. So as those charged particles pass through the atmosphere. They excite the gas of the atmosphere, and then when it de-excites, it emits ultraviolet light, so you can see the shower glowing in the ultraviolet.
Wow, that sounds kind of crazy. And also, the more you talk about it, what goes on out at the Dugway Proving Grounds, it makes me wonder how difficult it was. And was it just the University of Utah that applied to get space here? It seems really odd that they would grant that to you.
Well, there were ups and downs with the military that, you know, sometimes their funding was good and they weren't that interested to have us. And sometimes their funding was bad and they were like, oh, come on out and you can do more. So first we got on, we got the lease, but we had groups from the University of Chicago and University of Michigan join us, and eventually the University of Tokyo. In those days, we were doing mostly, as I say, the fluorescence telescopes. The Japanese were mostly doing a scintillator detector, which they had in a place called Akaino, Japan, which is one of their observatories sort of northwest of Tokyo. So to do that, you sprinkle the Earth with plastic detectors that are in light-tight boxes. And when the charged particles of that shower I was talking about come down and hit the Earth's surface, they have to pass through those boxes. And then you can measure the density of charged particles in that little space. And so you're measuring the footprint of the shower. And so that's a different technique than we were using. And for a long time in the late 90s, early 2000s, we were arguing a lot with those guys. You're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong. We get different answers, especially at the highest energies, like 10 to the 19, 10 to the 20th electron volts. So that's a one with like 19 or 20 zeros after really high energies, very high energies. So eventually, in 2003, we agreed to get together and build the telescope array, which is down by Delta. So you built that detector with both scintillator detectors and fluorescence telescopes, and now you can compare the answers that you're getting and see what problems each of these techniques have and get a better measurement of the cosmic rays.
So the two different big particles that have been detected in 1991 and 2021, one was found using or discovered using one sensor, and then the Amaterasu was found using a different sensor. Tell us the difference between those two discoveries.
Actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's the thing I find really interesting from my perspective. So the Oh My God particle was found using the fluorescence telescopes. And to be honest, the more crude telescopes, because we followed up the fly's eye with the high resolution fly's eye and then eventually telescope array. So like I said, the shower comes down, it's initiated by the charged particle high up in the atmosphere, and you get a shower of billions of secondary particles. You see that light from the particles as they de-excite. And that's a very, we say, calorimetric measurement. You understand the energy measurement, how much energy was dumped into the atmosphere, very well. You see the track as it comes down through the atmosphere. You can figure out, using both the pixels in the camera and the timing of the pixels, where did that come from? So it's a very well understood technique. So that particle was measured at 3.2 times 10 to the 20th electron volts, a humongous energy, an energy that either you shouldn't see, or if you do see, should come from a source very nearby. The reason for that is, as you get above about 10 to the 19.6 electron volts, those particles have a high probability to collide with the microwave background, which is the remnant light from the Big Bang that's everywhere in the universe. And when you collide with that, you're going to generate pion, which is another particle. And energy for that mass has to come from someplace. And so It comes from the kinetic energy of the primary cosmic ray. And so you really can limit how far away that should come from. And you look back, where does the oh my God particle come from? And there's nothing there. No violent objects. In contrast, the Amaterasu particle is measured by scintillator detectors, which are these plastic detectors in light-tight boxes that you sprinkle across the floor of the desert. And how you measure the energy from those is you look at how many detectors saw it, how many charged particles each of the detectors saw, and what's their timing. You can point it back even more accurately where it came from. But what we discovered when we paired these two techniques is really, you need to calibrate your scintillator detector using your fluorescence detectors, because the scintillator detectors are, it's not a calorimetric or really an energy measuring process. And so you're based on what do the models tell you. And the models are extrapolated from what we measure at particle accelerators like the Large Hadron Collider in CERN. And those only go up to 10 to the 13th electron volts. So you're extrapolating a lot of orders of magnitude.
So when we talk about this, we're talking about particle, like one particle. I mean, it seems like it's a pretty lucky that that one particle happened to hit those detectors, whether in 91 or 2021. But how many particles are coming at us all the time? I mean, if these tiny relatively spaces detected these particles, are we being bombarded with these energetically massive particles all the time?
The Earth is being bombarded with low energy and high energy particles all the time. Mostly you're protected from the low energy ones by the Earth's magnetic field, right? They get trapped by the magnetic field and sent up to the pole to generate aurora. At higher energies, they're breaking through the magnetic field. They're generating these showers. An individual particle at the high energies, it's one per square kilometer per century. You're never going to see it with a conventional technique. At low energies, you can send up a satellite or put something on the space station, and they do, and you can measure particles up to about 10 to the 15th electron volts. But to see these high energy things, you really need a huge detector, which is why we have the telescope array. It's currently something like 800 square miles in area. So it's big. And then, like I said, you're still talking about one per square kilometer per century. So you got to get lucky to find these really high energy particles.
Yeah. So I remember when the Higgs boson was discovered, I feel like it was back in the around 2010, 2012.
Sounds about right.
And that everyone in the particle and nuclear physics arena that was so excited about it, and it was so exciting. If we look at overall, when you know, these cosmic rays, can you help those of us who aren't physicists understand what the implications are, the practical implications, other than testing theories of nuclear and particle physics, do these cosmic rays have here on Earth?
Well, at the high energy end, it's mostly human curiosity, right? It's trying to understand the universe, what's out there, and especially when we talk about the really high energy and what are the really violent objects. You look out, you see these beautiful pictures from the various telescopes. What are they? What's going on? To get to the really high energies, now you're probably, we don't know, you're probably talking about something like a black hole eating another black hole and jets shooting out of it of the stuff that didn't quite get sucked in. And some of that stuff comes to us. We're trying to figure out what are those objects and then try to understand the physics of what's going on inside those objects. But at lower energies, I mean, all this stuff is affecting us all the time. It's affecting your computers. It's affecting you when you go, well, even here on Earth, it's a source of mutations and cancer, but worse when you go in an airplane, and worse yet if you're an astronaut, right? When you get outside of the Earth's magnetic field.
Yeah, that's all really interesting. I was wondering, John, you know, there's a very specific reason that you have the telescope array where you do out in the West Desert. And it has something to do also with elevation. Like you might ask yourself, like, why don't they just put these arrays to detect cosmic rays on the top of the Andes in Chile where they have the other telescopes, you know? Why don't they do that? And there is a reason. Can you explain?
Let me first back up and say that the original idea for this comes from for the telescopes anyway, comes from a guy named Ken Grayson. And he originally worked on the Manhattan Project, and he was interested in Manhattan Project days in how do you calibrate nuclear weapons exploding in the atmosphere. And what they figured out is that you have these charged particles that are going to excite the gas, and then you're going to get fluorescence light. So you can measure that. It's ultraviolet light. So after the Manhattan Project, he became a professor at Cornell University in upstate New York, and they're close to sea level. And if you've ever been to upstate New York, you know it's nice and green and there's plenty of humidity. And he tried to build a small prototype telescope and it didn't work. And there were lots of reasons, lots of reasons. But eventually some of those people from Cornell came to the University of Utah and they figured out you need dry air, you need a dark sky. And another thing you want to be is you want to be at about 4,000 feet. And the reason you want to be at about 4,000 feet is when the charged particle comes and hits a nucleus high up in the atmosphere, it splatters that nucleus and you get a bunch of secondary particles. Those travel a short distance and they do the same thing. So you build up that whole air shower, it's growing, growing, growing over many generations, right? Eventually what happens is you've traded all your kinetic energy for mass energy, and now you've got billions of secondary particles and they are low energy and they start to die off. So if you want to measure what's the chemical composition, what was that cosmic ray? Was it a proton? Was it a nitrogen? What was it? What you want to see is that shower grow and then turn over and die out, or at least be able to see that turnover. And if your cosmic rays are in the 10 to the 19th energy range, which is the range we want to study, then you want to be at about 4,000 feet. If you want to look at lower energy cosmic rays, then, and there are experiments that do that, then you want to be higher up. There's an experiment called Hawk, which is at 14,000 feet in a park in Mexico.
I was reading on your site that over the years, at least since 1991, you have observed more than 30 ultra high energy particles. And when we talked about in the intro and throughout this interview, you don't know where these particles are coming from, like what the source is anyway. So with this 30 or so particles that you've detected, are they coming from at least the same point in the galaxy or the universe?
We would like to see that. We would love to see that. So there's the Earth's magnetic field, there's the galaxy's magnetic field, and then there's the extragalactic magnetic field. And, you know, they get weaker and weaker, but they still affect the path of a charged particle. So we choose the highest energy cosmic rays, those above about 10 to the 20th electron volts. And we say to ourselves, those shouldn't be bent very much by the magnetic field. Those should go more or less straight. And then you plot where did they come from in the sky, and they come from everywhere and no particular direction. We see that, and there's a similar experiment based on guys that broke off from this group a long time ago and went down to Argentina, a city called Malargue, and they built a similar, even larger detector. It's mostly Europeans, and they see the same thing. The high energy particles come from sort of everywhere. So the question is, why? Why don't they point back to some place in the sky? We see hints that there might be something by the Big Dipper, hints that there might be something in the direction of the Perseus Pisces, but we would love to see a whole bunch of cosmic rays come from one place and then say, now let's narrow it down and figure out what that is.
like I said in the intro, they're coming from everywhere, but you don't know what they're coming from. Like the source is unknown. I mean, are there any theories?
Well, one theory is this black hole eating another black hole, active galactic nuclei. You need a really large, astronomically large object that has high magnetic field, high electric field to contain these charged particles. While they get accelerated, you contain things with a magnetic field, so they swirl around in more or less a circle as they get repeatedly accelerated by the electric fields, and then finally escape. That's the common idea of a large object source for these things. Another idea is maybe instead of a really large object, maybe you have just something that's an unstable and unseeable particle that we don't know what it is. And they're traveling around and wandering the universe. And then at some point, something makes them decay. And if you have something, it doesn't take that much mass to make a really energetic cosmic ray. So it could be something like that, that there's some strange dark matter that we don't know what it is or where it is, but maybe it's everywhere. And then they decay and you get these cosmic rays. I find that scary, but interesting.
Yeah. So it's always in the decay that you get the cosmic rays. Is that right?
That's where you get it from, the single particles. It would have to decay. But the really large things, there could be all kinds of things swirling around and then getting accelerated and eventually escape and come to us.
John, I'm wondering if the public would like to get a little more involved in this, in learning about cosmic rays and even being able to experience them. Is there a way? I mean, I know you can't go to Dugway, but Delta, Utah is what, like an hour and a half away from where Dugway is? Do you have some sort of center there that the public can experience?
We have a center in Delta. It's more like 2.5 hours.
Oh, is it? Okay.
All from Salt Lake, from the university.
Okay.
We don't drive from Dugway. We don't get to go to Dugway anymore. They told us you're done here.
You're no longer welcome.
But from the university, it's like 2.5 hours, and there's a small visitor center, and people are always happy to talk to you. And if you want to call us up or shoot us an email, we often arrange tours, especially to like school groups and things. We do tours, and then you can go out and see the telescopes and the scintillator detectors and things.
And looking at your website for the Telescope Array Project, you have another project called the Clear Sky Clock. What is that?
So the scintillator detectors are plastic, and they're enclosed in a stainless steel box, and they're powered by solar-powered batteries. They operate 24/7. They're in general just happy unless their computer has trouble or something, or a cow eats the GPS. But the telescopes, they're extremely sensitive. You're looking for something that's essentially maybe an 80 or 100 watt ultraviolet light bulb that's moving at the speed of light, and maybe it's 30 or 40 kilometers away from you. So they're extremely sensitive. So you can't take data when the sun's up. You can't take data when the moon's up. You can't take data when the weather's bad. You can't take data when it's cloudy. So the Clear Sky Clock is one of the tools that we use that tells us what's the weather likely to be like, how bad are the clouds likely to be. We're continuously looking at that and weather.gov to see how windy, how cold, how...
How many cows? I'm sure that's a very interesting conversation that you have at your astronomical conventions and the hazards that other astronomers face. Like, well, guess what? We've got cows and crows. Reading about you and your educational history, your whole education path has been based around these particles. What is it that has fascinated you with these cosmic rays and cosmic particles?
It's just wanting to know what exactly they are and where they're coming from. We've learned a lot over the years. You know, sometimes I feel like, you know, things are moving really slowly, but, you know, when you look back, we've learned an awful lot of things in the years that I've been here. We know a lot more about composition. We know a lot more about the spectrum. At the highest energies, there's still an awful lot of questions. What are they really, and where are they coming from? So you keep pushing that energy boundary higher. Where are the unknown unknowns?
Well, our guest today has been Dr. John Matthews of the Telescope Array Project in Delta, Utah. He is also with the University of Utah Physics Department. John, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio. We will leave links to the Telescope Array Project so that our listeners can learn more and possibly come down for a visit.
That'd be great. Thanks very much, ladies. I enjoyed it a lot.
On November 24, 1974, our next guest was walking across a site in Ethiopia when he saw bones, specifically an elbow bone, sticking out of the soil. Paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson and his team would go on to find 47 bones of the iconic fossil Lucy. He now celebrates the 50th anniversary of uncovering Lucy, and he joins us today to talk about how Lucy's discovery continues to be central to discovering key elements of the human story. Donald Johansson, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be with you today.
Well, we are so excited to talk about this. I think Lucy is almost a household name in terms of people know that there was this little hominid that peered one elbow out of the soil, and you went on to find a large number of bones that defined the entire skeleton. Wow. Can you believe it was 50 years ago?
Well, it's where did those 50 years go? But I distinctly remember that day. I mean, it's etched in my deep memory. I don't think there's a day since that discovery that I haven't mentioned the name Lucy at one time or another. People were fascinated with this discovery. For me, it was a defining moment of my career. It was at my feet, a childhood dream come true. I had, been inspired as a young teenager to look for human ancestors. Why? I mean, I was growing up in Connecticut, and how's a little Connecticut kid get excited about this at 13 years old? Well, he read a book called Man's Place in Nature by Thomas Henry Huxley. And I read that book because it was in my mentor's library. And it was right next to this very imposing and thick book with no pictures in it called The Origin of Species by Darwin, Charles Darwin. Mm. And I pulled out this little thin book, and it had pictures of Neanderthals. It had pictures of apes. And the seminal idea in that book, which was really written for the lay person by Thomas Henry Huxley way back in the late 1800s, and was that we shared a common history, prehistory, a common origin with the African apes. And to a 13-year-old, this was an explosive idea. And I just couldn't wait to tell all of my friends in high school that we were descended from a common ancestor with chimpanzees and gorillas.
And I'm so curious what your high school friends said when you told them that. I suspect they didn't care as deeply as you did, or maybe they did.
Well, there was a great avalanche of disbelief because so many of them were very traditional believers in the creation that we read about in the Bible. And this flew right in the face of their beliefs. They didn't want to change their mind. And some of the adults who I spoke with just thought it was a phase that this 13-year-old was going through. And, you know, eventually I would come to realize that that's impossible. But I do remember being a little bit provocative with my friends because I was not a church-going person. I was raised as an atheist by my mother and my mentor, who was a local professor who lived nearby. And he was an anthropologist. And what was exciting about meeting him when I was about 9 years old was that he introduced me to the world of cultural diversity. And when questions came up of, you know, how did we come to be? And is the Bible really true? And so on. He barraged me with wonderful examples of creation myths that are individually developed by different cultures. And he said, how do you choose which is the right one? He said, these are constructs of humankind. And the only thing that we can turn to that we can actually call scientific was Darwin's idea of descent with modification, origin of species. So I went to undergraduate school at the University of Illinois and studied anthropology and geology, getting myself ready to go to Africa, and was the first to go to the library when a new article was published in Science or Nature magazine, went to the chemistry building and Xeroxed that copy and brought it back to my little dorm room, and would read about a new discovery by Lewis Leakey. And these places were so exotic, you know, Tanzania and Kenya and Nairobi and Olduvai Gorge. And in college, you know, I was learning about these in my courses, and I just felt that this was what I wanted to do.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are having a conversation with paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson. He was part of the team that first discovered Lucy in the Ethiopian desert 50 years ago. All right, well, Lucy, like you said, is a household name, and everyone knows pretty much who Lucy is. And I love this story. Tell us how she got her name.
Well, we, after the initial discovery that Sunday morning, went back to camp. Everybody was very excited about this. And the team decided that we needed to have a celebration that night. And I've been an avid Beatles fan right from the beginning. And I put on Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band on my little Sony tape recorder, and it was playing, and students had snuck in some beer and cooled it down in, you know, one of these sacks hanging from a tree, and we were all very excited about it. And all the questions were flying. Who do you think this is? What was this? How old do you think it was? And so on. And I said, well, I think it was probably a female because the length of her thigh bone was only the length of a ruler. It was 12 inches long. Well, maybe it was a child. I said, nope, her third molar's erupted. The wisdom tooth is there. She was fully mature. So she would have been probably 3.5 feet or so tall. And so someone on the expedition, Pam, she said, you really think this is a female? I said, yes, why? And she said, well, why don't you name her Lucy after Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds? It's playing on the tape recorder. And I said, well, I'm a professor now. I have my PhD. I'm not going to give some cute little name to this creature. It should have a scientific name. But I didn't know who it was in terms of its biology. And so I didn't think much about it. We went to bed fairly late that evening. But at breakfast, Don, are we going back to the Lucy site? Do you think we'll find more of Lucy's skull? How old do you think Lucy was? And it was out of the bag, and you could not change it. And even the Ministry of Culture in Addis Ababa sent a delegation out to see this remarkable discovery. And one of the officials said, you know, she's Ethiopian. And she needs an Ethiopian name. And I, you know, my Ethiopian vocabulary is not exactly extensive. And he said, I think you should call her Dinkanesh. And I nodded and I said, well, what does Dinkanesh mean? And he said, it means you are wonderful. And so she has an Ethiopian name as well as an anglicized name, Lucy.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, what made the, or what's, I think it's still, what makes this area of the world, specifically of Africa, such a warehouse of these ancient artifacts? Because there's been a number of findings in the area.
Oh, the findings are endless. One of the major influences in Eastern Africa, beginning way down south in Mozambique, is the beginning of the Great Rift Valley. And this is due to continental drift or plate tectonics. The Horn of Africa is moving slowly away from Africa. And it has created in Ethiopia an extremely large area called the Afar Triangle. And it's resurrecting sediments that have been laid down for really literally tens of millions of years. And at the site of Hadar, where Lucy was found, the sediments are between 3 and 3.5 million years in age. And I first visited the site in 1972 with a French colleague, a geologist who had been studying the geology of the Afar Triangle. And he said, you know, there are lots of bones in this area. You have to come with me to find the real ancestor of man. He was a wonderful animated guy, the late Maurice Taieb. I met him in Paris in a lab. And he was so generous. He invited me, and of all things, an American, to go with him on an exploratory expedition. And there were fossils everywhere. It was just extraordinary how fossil-rich the area was. Everything from, you know, fossil rodents, everything from the tiny things like fossil pollen. Yes, pollen fossilizes. You can say something about the kinds of plants that were there. But everything from, you know, rodent-sized things right on up to complete elephant skulls with their tusks and so on. And importantly, the elephants and the fossil pigs, there's a just recently deceased paleontologist who spent his whole life studying fossil pigs, evolved very quickly over time. They respond very quickly to environmental change. And the pigs suggested to me, and the elephants, because I've been previously working in southern Ethiopia as a graduate student, that the site was older than 3 million years. And why that was so important was that all of the human fossils, the fossils on the human family tree, older than 3 million, you could fit into the palm of your hand. There was a fragment of a mandible, a bit of an arm, a single tooth, and I hypothesized that if we could find human ancestor fossils older than 3 million years, we would open up an entirely new vista on our very ancient beginnings.
Okay, so Lucy is approximately 3.18 million, and sometimes people will say, round up and say 3.2 million years old, and rounding up, I mean, if you think about the difference between 3.18 and 3.2, yeah, it's immense. But what would it be that you were looking for if a fossil was beyond 3 million years? What did you think or hypothesize that you would be able to find at that point?
Well, I was often asked when I headed off to these expeditions by reporters. I was at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History and teaching at Case Western Reserve. They say, what do you expect to find? And my answer always was the unexpected. We don't know what we're going to find. But if there are human ancestor fossils that go back to about 2.5 million, that doesn't mean that that was their beginning. They had to have had ancestors. So what I was expecting and what I was hoping to find were human ancestor fossils that were much older than 3 million years, which of course we did.
Yes. Well, Lucy was both ape-like and human-like. Can you talk about the process of finding out how she was human-like in addition to ape-like.
Yeah, we I had all of these fossils on loan because there was really no place to work on these in the National Museum in Ethiopia. Today, the government is invested very heavily in laboratories and storage facilities and so on, so fossils don't leave the country. But I had these fossils in my lab on a five-year loan. We had to sort of clean them up and get the stone off of them, what we call the matrix. And I invited a team to come in, someone to study the skull parts, somebody to study the hands, somebody to study the feet, somebody to study the teeth and jaws. I did the teeth, a colleague of mine did the jaws. And we began to work ourselves systematically through a long comparative study. In the early, in the mid-70s, just after Lucy was found and ensuing years, I traveled extensively and looked at every Australopithecus fossil that had ever been found. This is a name that Raymond Dart gave it 100 years ago. Actually, this is the 100th anniversary of the first discovery of a human ancestor in Africa that was found in South Africa called the Tong Child. And there are extensive collections there. And what began to emerge was that there were distinctive features, especially in the teeth and jaws and skulls, that were more ape-like than anything we had seen before. And in addition to that, I worked with someone on the biomechanics of how Lucy might have gotten around. And our pelvis, what we're all sitting on now, is very different from the family dog, for example, that walks on all fours. And in the hip and the knee and the foot was the classic anatomy of a creature that was upright walking. So from that perspective, she was walking very much like we do today. That means the hands were freed from locomotion. But when you looked at the skull, it was a very small skull. It was, a third to a fourth the size of our modern human skulls. So it meant that upright walking came before brain expansion. And at the conclusion of this team working very intensely for a number of years, in 1978, we announced her as a new kind of human ancestor, and we called her Australopithecus afarensis, after the Afar region and the Afar people who were there. And this demanded that we take a harder look, a closer look, at where she sat on the human family tree. And being a young scholar and much more adventurous and willing to take risks, I placed her as a common ancestor to all the later branches on the human family tree. And that caused an enormous debate. And yet today, 50 years later, all discoveries that have been made in the Afar between, say, 2 and 3 million, the earliest and oldest ones, have a mixture of characteristics of Lucy's species and the species that they're evolving into. So it looks like she is the last common ancestor, her species. And we have, 500 specimens of her now, not as complete as Lucy, but complete skulls and long bones and lots of teeth and jaws and so on. And taken together, this reference collection is the go-to collection for paleoanthropologists to go to at the Natural History, at the Ethiopian National Museum, when they make new discoveries.
Well, you say that, I'm hopefully going to say this right. Lucy was an Australopithecus?
Yes.
Okay, so that was her species, her genus.
That was her genus.
What other genus have you found of that area, or are all of the fossilized humanoid remains that same genus?
There are other remains of Homo in the afar, there's Ardipithecus, which is goes back to about 4.2 million years, 4.4 million years ago. There are a number of different species of Australopithecus. So the afar actually preserves fossils as old as 6 million years, right on up to the emergence of our own genus Homo. One of the things that is so interesting in a recent article I published with a colleague of mine, Johannes Haile Selassie from the Institute of Human Origins, that I founded way back in 1981, it is very enlightening because at Hadar, where Lucy was found, we have over, 200 specimens of her species, Afarensis, but no other species of Australopithecus. Yet in the area where Johannes works, which is, just north of us, there are a couple of other species. And we're trying to figure out why was Hadar exclusively made up of only Lucy's species? And why was his area supporting several species of early hominins? So that is a question that we are currently thinking about. It probably has something to do with environmental diversity, but we want to be, more detailed about that.
So you said that your evaluation of the fossil of Lucy led you to understand that she was walking upright, had her hands free. And those two things sound like major evolutionary advancements alone. But were there any other evolutionary key points that her species really displayed that helped us be who we are today?
Well, there's been recent intensive work done on reconstructing cranial capacity in virtual space. And the average capacity of the brain is about 20% larger than what we see in contemporary chimpanzees. So it appears that already there may have been selection, natural selection, for an increase in brain size. What that means, we don't know. There are no stone tools at Hadar, so it wasn't for making tools. Were they living in a richer, more complicated social system? Did they have somewhat prolonged infancy periods because they had more to learn? Certainly, the brain is selected not only for, making tools and so on, but it's for understanding the world they lived in. So that's something very recent that we've begun to look into.
Mm. We're speaking with Donald Johansson. He discovered Lucy. That discovery was made 50 years ago in November. And we're talking to him about, well, the controversy is one of those things. And I wanted to ask you about this, Donald, is that initially, even some scientists were arguing that Lucy's skeleton could have shown that she was more like a chimpanzee that sort of used knees, used feet sometimes, used hands sometimes. But then there was this other thing that confirmed, well, it was the footprint. It confirmed that she did walk upright. Can you talk about those footprints that were found?
Sure. And you're absolutely right, Lynn, that there was a lot of controversy. There were a whole team of anatomists who said, no, Lucy walked with a bent knee and bent hip, like you see in these reconstructions of what supposedly our earliest ancestors looked like. And we stuck to our guns and said that the knee is exactly like the knees that orthopedic surgeons put in people who need knee replacements, had all the detailed anatomy of that. The pelvis wasn't identical to a modern human, but it was basin-like, supporting the organs in the abdomen. And the femur, the thigh bone, at the top had all of the features of an upright walker. But I invited the late Richard and Mary Leakey to visit our camp. I was really proud of this and wanted to share it with them. And they came to visit, they were incredibly impressed by the density of fossils. But Mary went back thinking about a site that she and her late husband, Louis Leakey, had visited in 1939. And there weren't any, they weren't interested in the site because there weren't any tools. So they thought there couldn't be any human ancestors there. Well, she went back to the site and they began to find teeth and jaws of a hominin. And those teeth and jaws were identical to the ones at Hadar. So it was the same species. And lo and behold, they found in a layer of volcanic ash that was 3.7 million years old, all right, much older than Lucy, footprints of elephants, of rhinos, of giraffes, of baboons, of little dung beetles crawling across this volcanic ash, raindrops in that ash. Then one day they found a heel print of what they thought was from a human foot. And they peeled back this layer of ash, and there was a footprint trail left by at least two of our ancestors walking side by side. There's only Australopithecus afarensis at Laetoli, is the name of the site in northern Tanzania. And these were footprints left by some of Lucy's relatives, distant relatives, ancestors to Lucy, of course, at 3.7 million years. And the great toe, which in our closest relatives is a big divergent toe for grasping and climbing if you go look at a chimp at your local zoo. But these footprints are the kind of footprints that all of us leave in the beach sand when we go to the beach during the summer. There's a strong heel strike. There's a roll off on the side of the foot. There's an arch to the from front to back and side to side, and a large great toe, as we call it, that is part of the of our upright walking success because it's used as a propulsive device to move us forward rather than grasping. But, you know, a creature as small as Lucy, I suspect, would certainly still have had the ability to climb up into the trees at night for safety mm-hmm. and probably for procuring things like birds' eggs or lizards or fruit or whatever they were eating. They were predominantly vegetarians, but certainly there were lots of attractive things in the trees and also for security at night. There were hungry carnivores on that landscape who would love to have had a little Lucy for an hors d'oeuvre.
Well, Donald, you are the founding director of the Institute of Human Origins at Arizona State University. So for all of these years, these 50 years, you've been still very active in the paleoanthropology world. Can you briefly tell us what kinds of discoveries that Lucy has, you know, over the 50 years that she no doubt has been studied and with new technology, what more have we learned?
We're one of the most important discoveries is the discovery of her ancestor, which we believe was a different species, Australopithecus anamensis. It's known from the Lake Turkana region in northern Kenya. But Johannes Haile Selassie, who I mentioned, who's now director of IHO, an Ethiopian-born paleoanthropologist. A few years ago, his team made a fantastic discovery of a complete skull.
That was paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson, and he was talking about the 50th anniversary of his discovery of the iconic fossil Lucy. Go to wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Cool Science Radio.